Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined as always... magnificent, marvelous Max Montana.
Thank you, Chad. How are you guys doing?
that was a very complimentary, magnificent and marvelous.
Yes, that was incredible.
Max gets in a bad mood, he's malevolent Max Montana.
Could be.
Sometimes mischievous Max Montana. Yeah.
There's a lot of N alliteration that can go on there.
Yeah, we'll run out of them eventually, that's for sure. Mischievous Max Montana.
I like that one. Mischievous?
That's the Max Montana that's had... 4, possibly 5 High West Stouts.
I still have the scar. It's formed into an actual scar now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
One day the viewers can know about the story. So today's podcast is brought to you by Milligrams and Kilograms. They were very excited to sponsor this episode as discuss the new Netflix documentary, Icarus. This is a movie by director and star Brian Fogel and features Grigory Rodchenkov. Becomes the star of it. But
it's a zany cast.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen it yet, you probably want to watch it before you listen to this podcast for the spoiler alert, so you've been properly warned. So
people are taking drugs.
I guess it's already happened in real life, so maybe it's not a spoiler alert. Watch the movie before you listen to the podcast, I think, not the other way around. So it just released maybe two weeks ago at the time that you're watching this, and Max and I watched it last night. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Incredibly well done. Yeah. Interesting. You feel for the people in it. Like, it's a documentary, but you really got kind of attached to Rodchenkov.
For sure.
Like a movie character.
Yeah. It was a very well done documentary. I mean, aside from the subject matter.
Yeah.
It was good.
What were your impressions going into the movie? What were you expecting?
You know, I thought it was gonna be much more like, I don't want to say like buy it, like I thought it was gonna be much more of just like a look at how bad and like all these people that like all the Russians, all the people doing the doping, this whole thing is just these evil people. But I thought it did a good job of sort of showing the human side to, you know, Rodchenkov and then what, you know, where he was at, but also possibly like showing the side of like there's people involved. It's not just this evil machine that's, you know, that's kind of churning out these people. I mean, obviously there's a huge component, but I was thinking it was just going to be this totally like, you know, sort of fluff piece of like whatever, Russia's evil, they take drugs and they cheat. Yeah, it largely is, but it's done well. Yeah.
Just the documentary version of the part of Rocky IV where Ivan Drago is getting his punching power measured and then extreme close-ups of syringes.
Extreme syringe close-up. Yeah. That was my expectation, right? And then, but it, you know, it was in-depth enough that I thought it was pretty cool to see that, the characters.
Yeah, you know, the previews of it that I had seen... And what I knew of it before I watched it, I expected a much different movie in that I expected, you know, if you've seen the movie Super Size Me with Morgan Spurlock where he eats McDonald's every day, I was expecting this movie to be that. And I thought at least the preview that I saw alluded much more to this, that the movie was going to be about Brian Fogel, the director, taking steroids, trying to beat drug tests, and doing this bicycle race. And it starts out like that, but it turned into so much more, and I think particularly interesting to us and hopefully the listeners and viewers of the podcast, because over the last year, you know, maybe 18 months that we've been doing Jug Life Podcast, without a doubt our most popular topic, even more popular than making fun of high multiply squats, has been positive drug tests, has been doping scandal related to Russia, related to, you know, retroactive testing and all this stuff that went around the 2016 Olympics. And this movie goes so in depth to that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we were talking too that when we watch it, we've been around a lot of these stories and people, and you know, I had experience, you had experience with Klokov, and I had experience with Abdeyev, like people that are in the thick of what's going on, and they'll tell you the honest story, but it's hard to grasp because the way they present it is usually from like their side of like it's always. There's a little hyperbole here and there, or you don't know exactly what it is. They just try to make the point like, oh, yeah, it's like everybody in Russia does, you know, does doping and this and that. But you don't really grasp what that means. The film does a great job of highlighting the like, depth to which this thing was going on.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the stories we got. So going into it, you're not surprised, like, oh, my God, everyone's doping in Russia. But then you start to realize the actual thing, like, holy shit, everybody in Russia is doping. And, like, it sets in a lot more, even though we had a ton of experience with those people and the stories before and kind of knowing it. I thought that was pretty cool.
And I think one of the big differences is the way that sport is organized in Russia versus America. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of across the board, that whether it's, you know, holdovers of communist system versus capitalism here, but there's a much more centralized organization for the sport governing bodies, individual sport governing bodies, as well as this ministry of sport. Yeah. I mean, there is a government official called the Minister of Sport. That does not exist in America.
No, not at all.
Where in the U.S., whether it's weightlifting, it's track and field, whatever, it's, you know, this little camp over here versus this team, and they're all kind of doing their own thing, and we'll talk about the kind of implications of that a bit more later. But with that centralized system, it lends itself much more to this overreaching, overarching conspiracy, corruption,
right,
it affecting everyone, not just these three or four people who train at this place or wherever it is.
Yeah, it's not just like pockets, right? Yeah. There's no like, oh, this one club is doing drugs, you know, and this other one's not. Like it's that's just entire, everything is interconnected.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And there's money to interconnect.
Right.
All of it. Right. And support. So if you haven't watched it, do that. Do it before you listen to the rest of this. I mean, 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Two thumbs up.
Yeah. Very good.
5 stars. Other. Yeah.
Truffle shuffle.
Yeah. 3 truffle shuffles. Is that a full top rating?
It's the highest rating you get on a truffle shuffle. It's 3 of them in a row.
Yeah. So the movie really, it starts out, and this is going to be, you know, a bit of recap and then our kind of analysis along the way, whether some of that's anecdotal or just our interpretation of things. The movie starts out with the director, Brian Fogel, discussing his desire to compete in this amateur bike race, this very competitive amateur bike race that he had done the year before, and I believe gotten 14th in it. And
clean, totally natural. Yeah.
And his idea was, okay, I'm going to come back and do this bike race, but do it. I'm going to dope through it. I'm going to Lance Armstrong the situation. You know, he came with Lance Armstrong being his hero, kind of growing up in the world of cycling. And he's going to Lance Armstrong this race and document the whole thing and try and sort of expose this system of, oh, you know, doping doesn't really work. You know, like so many YouTube commenters, Brian Fogel had the same idea. Well, it's so easy to beat.
Right. Well, I think the whole thing, too, that was kind of inspired him was that Lance Armstrong never actually failed a drug test.
Correct.
He had been tested many, like dozens and dozens of times, possibly hundreds of times.
Yeah, I think the number they quote in the movie is 150 times.
150 tests, right? And never a single positive. So
he won 7 Tour de France's, so that's, let's say, 20 tests a year, a couple more than that, probably more as he went.
Yeah.
Which, in the grand scheme of drug testing,
I thought they had said 500.
Was it 500?
I thought it was 500 total tests.
Okay.
That would make more sense because that would be, what, about 100 a year? No. Less about 80 a year.
75 a year. Yeah, that's certainly much harder to beat. But, yeah, in the grand scheme of drug testing from people we've talked to Jordan Clark, who is a world championship team shot putter who we had on last year, told us that he was tested 50 times in the year.
You don't even need a toilet bowl anymore.
I heard about Usain Bolt at least 2012, if not 2008 Olympics, being tested like 14 times during the week of the Olympics, complaining about the testing process to the point of like, they're waking me up at 1 or 2 in the morning. Like, how much blood are they going to draw here?
Right,
like,
right.
I need this blood for energy to do.
Like, that is
hey,
crazy.
Can we push back the start of the 100 here? I just donated blood. So
that is nuts.
Yeah. So very prevalent drug testing. But a couple notes about Lance Armstrong drug testing. Think, you know, whatever you think about Lance Armstrong, I'm very much of the opinion that, you know, he was not – Lance Armstrong's crime was not taking drugs to win the Tour de France, because they've shown that he would have been going down to the 50th place person who was actually clean, maybe if you wanted to take everyone out who was on drugs. So that was not – you know, if Lance Armstrong is a bad guy, it's not because he took drugs to win the Tour de France. It's probably because
he's a fucking bad dude.
Yeah, people who pointed out that he was taking drugs, he went to extreme measures to ruin their lives. But it's like, well, does the end justify the means of raising all this money? That's a different debate. But something important to note about Lance Armstrong's drug testing is that the UCI, the world governing organization for cycling at the time, their ratio and, you know, test to epitestosterone ratio is sort of the number one, the first step of drug testing is establishing this ratio, was 10-1. 10-1 testosterone to epitestosterone ratio, while, you know, track and field was 6-1 and might even be 4-1.
Yeah, it's 4-1 now. And yeah. I think like an average human, normal person is 1-1, 2-1 is high. And certainly there's probably people walking around at 4-1 or whatever. But,
yeah.
But
I think, was it Alistair Overeem was 53-1 or something one of the times he tested?
Yeah.
And tried to claim that that was all. He's just a very
he's
real
a better
man. He's a real manly
dude. I saw him in Thailand.
Yeah,
in the hospital.
Yeah.
A couple of syringes sticking out of his shoulder. You want to brush that off.
Yeah. But 10-1 was the acceptable ratio. So if I was to have to guess of who would naturally have higher testosterone, you know, gold medal shot putter or Tour de France cyclists.
Flash a picture of Lance Armstrong here flexing.
Yeah. I'm going with the shot putter. So to give the cyclists already twice as much leeway before having an issue seems like, well, they were really making it easy for Lance to beat it. And in one of the documentaries, there are so many documentaries about Lance Armstrong now, and the name of this one escapes me. I know it's not the one that Stop at Nothing. It's not that one.
Master of Spin.
Is that one of them?
I'm pretty sure it's a documentary, yeah.
About Lance Armstrong?
I thought it was like Lance Armstrong's workout video, but it's actually a documentary on his destruction of other people's lives.
But in it, he mentions that, the Armstrong lie. Oh. I think that's the one that he references. This is that all the tests, when he would get close to 10-1 ratio, the UCI was like warning him. They're like, hey, you're getting close. So how many tests did he have that would have been over 6-1, over the track and field standard at the time, but less than 10-1? That's a lot of leeway. So, you know, in the argument of, well, it's easy to beat drug tests, at that time, certainly the UCI was making it pretty easy on him, just relative to even other sports.
Yeah.
But so Brian Fogel, the director, sets out to make this movie to dope and to do better in this bike race and to beat the tests. In it, he begins to enlist the help of Don Catlin, who is the director of the UCLA lab. He invented the test for HGH, one of the most prominent figures in American drug testing, USADA, you know, WADA, alongside the aptly named Dick Pound, one of the real prominent characters.
Dick Pound.
Yes. One of the real prominent characters of U.S. anti-doping movement. So he talks to Don Catlin. He hires, you know, a trainer and nutritionist, anti-aging specialists, all to help him with this. And I read, got a $350,000 one of his friends,
right?
Yeah, one of his friends funded the film and the process with $350,000, and eventually Don Catlin realizes, like, yeah, this is probably too much to help this guy beat.
Yeah, he didn't want to tarnish his reputation, yeah. Like showing that he could help this guy pass a test, and then, you know, that would just look bad, I think.
Yeah, and
smart move.
Yeah, so in that, Don Catlin decides to, like, hey, I'm going to take a step back, but I know a guy who will be more than willing to help you out.
Yeah.
And boy, does he know a guy.
Yes, that is a one-of-a-kind man.
Maybe it's just editing or whatever, but at this point he introduces Brian Fogle to Gregory Rodchenkov.
A very, very Russian yes. man.
Who is the head, the director of the WADA-accredited lab in Russia. And maybe it's just the way that the film is edited, but it gives the impression that Catlin, you know, gives him Grigori's Skype name. He Skypes him, and it's like, hi, my name's Brian. I'm Grigori. Oh, you have a cool dog. I have a cool dog, too. Look, so beating drug tests, yes. Like, no vetting process. Wow. No, like, there's no, like, secret handshake or code word. I will
say that... And I'm not going to – I probably shouldn't, like, whatever. I'm going to name names, whatever. But oh, – and it's – there's – I think there's a – if it was – if you had been anybody else contacting Rodchenkov, like, definitely there may have been a much more resisting kind of force. Like, oh, well, you don't know who you are if you're a sort of outsider. But when I – whenever I was – I've asked the people that coached the best lifters, what did they take? No hesitation. This much of this, this much of that. He did this and this and this, and that's when he did this number. Like, there's no resistance to it. And there may be if you're just a, you know, you run up to somebody at whatever world championships, hey, Kloglov, how much did you take? Like, you're not going to get an answer. But when you have some rapport because you're a lifter or a coach or you're one of the peers, like, it might be a little different. So I could see where maybe that would be the case because it was very similar, like –
And maybe you Don know, Catlin had contacted Grigori and sort of said, hey, this guy's cool. Yeah. Help him out.
I prefer to just think that's what he's doing.
Yeah. But it was so just nonchalant, just casual, like, oh, you're interested in beating drug tests? Cool. That's what I do.
Yeah. Well, he's also – he works for USADA, right? Or no, not USADA.
For WADA.
He works at the WADA laboratory. Yeah.
He is the director of the WADA lab. So they go on for about 6 months kind of corresponding back and forth – freezing urine and smuggling that to Russia and so on and so forth. For an important part of trying to beat the drug testing process in this is getting your own sample tested in a WADA-accredited lab. But guess what? People on the internet who think, like, oh, it's so easy to beat the tests, you know, you can't just Google the name of the lab and be like, hey, can I send my stuff there and you tell me if I pass or not? No, you have to have, like, contracts through SADA, through WADA, through these organizations. We know people who have tried to do this.
Yes, yeah, very much. It's not you can't just mail urine to a laboratory and get the full IOC panel, right? They just won't do it because they know exactly why you're doing that.
Yeah. So Brian Fogle goes through about 6 months of training with these professional coaches with doing testosterone, HDH, EPO, corresponding with Rodchenkov, working with nutritionists, all this stuff, and does definitely see improvements being yielded in his performance. I know he quotes from going at 250 watts maximum up to about 350 watts.
Yeah.
That's a very significant improvement. Now, it comes time, and Rodchenkov comes to the U.S., and they kind of become buddies, and that's all great. It comes time for him to do the race. He travels to France. Very important things to note. An important takeaway from this movie is Brian Fogle does the race. Yes, he has a mechanical problem with his bike in it, but he does not do any better than he did the year before. By his own admission, he says that, you know, even if he's having his best day, he would not have won the race. Like, drugs did not make him an instantaneous champion in his sport. Maybe are the other people doing drugs? Quite possibly. another very important takeaway. Brian Fogel never beats a drug test in this process.
Right.
He is never tested. They did not actually test at this race where testing was advertised. It was only a, you know, a scare tactic deterrent. Plus, the 6 months of which he is doping, there's no out-of-competition testing for amateur cycling. So, again, the argument of it's so easy to pass drug tests. In this scenario where you don't actually get tested, yeah, that's really easy to beat. And if they would have actually tested, he knew there's a one-week period during this race in which they may test me.
Yeah.
So he had, you know, 6 months to prepare, to train hard on drugs to know, okay, this takes this many days to clear, this takes this many days to clear. And that's what they're testing his urine for, you know, to find out the difference of, because I'd imagine that's just sort of individual body chemistry and stuff of it takes one person 6 days to clear and another person 9 days. So they could take it up to as close, take it as close to the race as possible.
Yeah.
But he didn't have to worry about out of competition testing. He wasn't putting his name, you know, updating. Like Marissa does this every day that she, you know, if we're traveling or whatever, updates on her Adams app. This is where I'm staying tonight. This is where you can find me from 6 to 7 a.m. tomorrow. And, you know, Brian Fogel was not having to do that.
Yeah.
Drug testing that where you know, like, this is the one day, the day of the competition, is the only day I can potentially be tested. Yes, that is easy to beat. That is having a calendar and knowing how to add and subtract.
Right, right. That's a big, that's a huge takeaway because it's, those are two very different things.
Yes.
The out of competition random, first of all, that term is wrong. People especially like to refer to random testing. There's no such thing as random drug testing.
Yeah.
Everything is unannounced drug testing. So there's no unannounced drug testing for him. He has a specific day and time, and then unfortunately it's just a ruse anyways because there's no testing. But yeah, this is a very, two very different things there. He's not circumventing or passing through, or, you know, unassigned or unannounced drug testing during the off season or off times.
Yeah. So two important takeaways from sort of this first quarter or third of the movie is that Brian Fogel makes nominal improvements as a cyclist. Really no competitive improvement. He does not do better in the same race on drugs than he did the year before off of drugs. Yes, mechanical problems contributed to that, but he says himself that, you know, it wasn't this like magic bullet kind of that he thought it was going to be, that he could have been younger. Yeah, I think in it he says, like, he could have been 21 years old and on all the tests and EPO that he wants, and he still isn't a pro cyclist. He's still not the Tour de France champion. So those are two very important takeaways. He never beat any drug tests, and it didn't instantaneously make him a super competitor. And I'm assuming that before he set out to make this movie and had $350,000 to work towards this, that he didn't have a professional coach and a professional nutritionist, let alone people analyzing his urine and blood for all kind of different hormonal levels.
Right.
So
yeah, for sure.
It's like it doesn't make you. It's not.
He had like a flopped play and movie, I think, before.
Yeah. Jutopia. Yes. Which apparently got a 1% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, brutal.
Brutal. But it was a good play, but the movie version got 1%.
Yeah. Jennifer Garner probably looked at that.
So at that point, though, sort of after the bike race, and he goes to visit Rodchenkov in Russia, and this is the point in the story where I know in his own creation of the movie from articles we've read, the whole thing takes a turn. It's not it's not supersized me for steroids anymore. Now it's like, holy shit, there's some stuff going down.
Well, because at the time he was doing it, the German documentary came out about this whole thing, about the widespread doping in Russia and this whole systematic thing and everything. And he's in Russia, and he kind of sees this and, you know, realizes Rodchenkov's like, you know, maybe the editing is, you know, he told him what it was going on, but like, you know, there's a movie about him now and everyone knows what this guy is and what's going on there. So that's when he just, you know, kind of turns and the story shifts to being basically about Rodchenkov and what's going on in, in the entirety of Russian doping and the machine behind it.
And if you're interested in seeing that movie, we have not watched that one. That is probably on the to-dos in the next week or so. But it was made by the German broadcaster ARD, and I believe it is called How Russia Makes Its Champions. The Doping Secret, How Russia Creates Its Champions. Hopefully it has subtitles, otherwise it's going to be really weird
it's German,
to watch.
Right?
So that comes out. There's some whistleblowers in that, people who the movie is not released until they are removed from the country. Because as it becomes very clear through the rest of the movie, Russia ain't playing no shit. They ain't never been about playing no shit
when it comes
to doping and getting found out about that.
Yep. A lot of people having heart attacks.
So it continues with more and more information. Rodchenkov fleeing to the United States to become a state's witness for the U.S. Department of Justice. You know, all these investigations going on, WADA commissions, investigations, I guess U.S. Department of Justice investigations of Russia, of doping allegations, of the organization, corruption, state-sponsored aspect of it that ends up resulting in kind of a whole lot of nothing. You know, track got banned. Weightlifting didn't compete, but the exact number, it was like 250 of 380 Russian Olympians were still allowed to compete in the Olympics after this independent commission found, 100% of doping samples had been tampered with. That they,
it's ridiculous.
100%.
Sending, and not even, I don't even think the Russian lifters were banned. They just chose not to attend. The decision was for them not to attend. My assumption is that they maybe knew this was probably not going to be good if we go with the current situation that happened. Because of all the sports that would potentially benefit most from doping, weightlifting's pretty high on that list.
Yeah. They're like, we'll send the rhythmic gymnasts.
Yeah, they'll be a little slower and they won't perform as well, but it won't be, you're not going to have some Russian dude go in there and snatch 150 when he was doing 185 before.
Yeah. And so a little bit more on the story of, what they were blowing the whistle on and everything. And it goes back to 2008. And in it, they talk about how China is this mass producer of anabolic steroids at pharmaceutical grade in labs and all that stuff. The IOC says, hey, you guys are hosting the Olympics this year. You got to knock this shit out. They stopped doing that. At that point, steroid production goes underground on the mass scale. And when you think that you're getting, a 10-milligram Anavar tablet, maybe it's 8 milligrams of Anavar and 2 milligrams of something else, and this clears in this time and this clears in this time, but you have no way of knowing. And I've had a very high-level Russian athlete tell me about that exact issue, how it was so difficult to find, pure substances for performance enhancement in Russia, and that really made it a lot harder to cheat.
Yeah.
It was a lot harder to figure out when you needed to come off when you didn't know exactly what you were coming off. And that is sort of where Rodchenkov sort of rose in power inside the Russian anti-doping world.
That's what I want. Yeah, I guess that's really what it is, anti-WADA.
Yeah, the anti-doping world. And sort of surpasses the other figure who was the leader at the time, whose name escapes me, but Portugayev, something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember now.
Yeah, and at that point, you also see the corruption beginning to just get laid out. I mean, this rivalry is created, and Rodchenkov gets thrown in jail and gets thrown in mental institutions, and was he doing stuff illegally? Yes, probably. But,
I feel like the word illegal doesn't belong in the Russian vocabulary. It's just kind of like punishable or not punishable, or punishable at this moment or not, right? But, anyways, the rivalry ensues, right? And then, you know, long story short on that, he ends up, Rodchenkov ends up back in power in 2012, right?
Yes.
Back as the head of the WADA lab in Russia and involved in it. And that, to me, is an interesting, I was talking earlier with Chad about it. It's an interesting, perspective as to clearly this guy is dirty before. He's been, there's several things. One is that he's clearly not playing by the official rules. He's playing by Russia's rules. He's put into power, I think, by WADA. I'm not entirely clear on that.
My impression is that Rodchenkov is an employee of WADA,
right,
who runs the WADA lab in Russia. That, the U.S. has WADA labs here that are run by WADA employees, not USADA employees. So Rodchenkov was not in the chain of Minister of Sport, Mikhail Mutko, Minister of Sport, and then Deputy Minister of Sport, and the USADA side of things. He is an employee of WADA, but it's all very murky.
It's hard to know exactly. Anyways, he gets back in power. He gets put back in this position, this role, and then he's basically given a chance to redeem himself or whatever, capitalize on this from Russia's standpoint, and now he's the guy who's in charge of making sure athletes pass tests.
And Rodchenkov definitely fancies himself a scientist.
Yeah, he
is about beating the test in the sense of, we're going to test ourselves and come off at the right time, and we know they can test for this compound, you have to come off at this time, and so on and so forth.
What I think is interesting, and you see this a lot in the film, and just like the subtlety of the way he communicates with Fogel, and kind of how they talk about a lot of stuff, there isn't a sense of like apathy towards the sport, whatever, everyone's on drugs, who cares. They really, he really truly believes in all of the things that I think we believe in here about sport, and the character and pushing and winning and this fight and this victory. He talked about when he's kind of doing the race, kind of motivate him and talk mm-hmm. about it. And it isn't just a joke to them. Even though everyone is doping on a grand scale, they don't look at it as anything, but that's just what sports is, right? A very interesting thought to me that there didn't seem to be any sense of disillusionment with sport because it's just totally corrupt and whatever.
Yeah, if anything, there's more
lots of pride in it.
Yeah, more pride in it. So Rodchenkov is about beating the tests by coming off at the right time, by taking the right compounds that clear faster and that sort of thing. Something that I've always thought is interesting. And if you're familiar with Balco, Victor Conti, the book Game of Shadows, Patrick Arnold was the chemist, and that whole scandal in the U.S. with Marion Jones, Barry Bonds, all these people, they were taking drugs that could not be tested for, that USADA and WADA did not know what they were, hence they could not test for them. It's surprising to me that And maybe this is happening and they just haven't caught him yet, but that Russia would go the route of, all right, let's just make sure we come off on time. And then the latter route that we'll discuss in a minute of another way to beat the test,
right,
versus, we're state sponsoring all this stuff and putting so much support towards the athletes. And it is substantial. I mean, Klokov told me that the senior national lifters were getting paid $8,000 to $12,000 a month U.S., and $8,000 to $12,000 a month U.S. in Russia
translates to $17 million a year.
Yeah, I mean, the highest stipend that any U.S. lifter actually probably gets is maybe $3,500,
yeah, something like that.
So they're getting 2 to 3 times that, but in a place where the cost of living is
pennies.
Yeah. On
the dollar.
It would be like a U.S. lifter getting paid, $20,000, $30,000 a month, I think.
Yeah, probably.
And so they're putting a ton of support towards these sports. Why not just task a chemist or team of chemists to make something that they don't know how to test for? But that is not the route that they've chosen to go, or it just hasn't been found out yet. And I kind of always thought that China was maybe more likely to be doing that. And it wasn't that they were coming off or that kind of thing, but that they were just taking stuff that people didn't know how to test for. And then when we saw the string of positives, retroactive positives from Beijing, that sort of changed my mind on that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, there's also things we've heard from people who are in the know type of people that that what they're saying they test positive for, they weren't actually taking.
Yeah, that's and tough. It's a...
It's corruption in every direction.
And there's so many lies and so much, like, no one's going to tell you exactly what's going on. But that kind of corroborates, too, a lot of what I've heard from my experience with a lot of the Eastern European guys, that there was no secret drug that no one knew about. You know, it was purely just cleverness and ingenuity passing tests, you know? Or, I mean... even more corrupt than just people being, you know, avoiding testing, right?
Yeah. And but then from the corruption the other side, the WADA corruption side or the IOC corruption side, that's when you get the Ben Johnson, Charlie Francis kind of thing, where Charlie Francis is like, stenazolol. My guys, I don't want my guys on stenazolol on race day. It makes them tight. He's not saying no, he wasn't on drugs.
Right.
He's saying no, he wasn't taking that. You know, he didn't test positive for that. They're making that up.
Yeah. And so Abu Jaya said too, a lot of his guys failed. They all failed for diuretics, and his thing was they didn't take diuretics.
Yeah,
they were taking stuff, but you know they were clean.
And this is obviously all pre-2008, pre the time where you wouldn't have been able to get.
Well, they made the stories I was told they actually had a factory that was making the drugs for them in Bulgaria. And then in like 1988, there was a ship.
When you say factory, do you mean bathtub?
A bathroom factory. And they had like, you know, they just had exactly what they were getting, and they knew exactly what it was because it was being manufactured there. So,
yeah. So that takes us to the point in the movie. Rodchenkov is running the lab. He's back doing his thing. He's the man when it comes to Russian anti-doping. Both anti-doping and anti-anti-doping. And then they come up to the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics. And this, I think, you know, for as much as Max and I have talked about this stuff and people we know who kind of know and stuff we've been around, the part that was the most eye-opening, I think, to the both of us was the scale of corruption that Russia employs at the Sochi Olympics. And... Real Sports on HBO with Bryant Gumbel had some specials about this, and you can probably, you know, YouTube all kind of different little pieces from Vice and all that sort of stuff about, you know, one, any Olympics, anyone who's hosting the Olympics bribed the shit out of people to be able to do that. Same thing with the World Cup, you know, that's how you get it. You bribe people, you know, you pay people off. And then you... You know, this was the case for 2008 Beijing. It was definitely the case for 2014 in Sochi. You employ this eminent domain type of thing to just move people out of their homes. This happened in Rio, too. Like, you guys get out of here. This is Olympic stadiums now and Olympic villages. And no, you don't get shit for this. You're just out, you know, you're homeless now. And so
incredible. We have it pretty bad here in the U.S.
Yeah. So incredible levels of corruption to get the Olympics and to... You know, the amount of tax money being used to build these stadiums that, you know, a year later, 2 years later are abandoned, are in, you know, ill repair. And to Russia and to Putin and the way that Real Sports frames it and some of my takeaway from this movie, too, is that sport there is a political tool. It is Rocky IV.
Yeah.
In 1985, you know, in the height of the Cold War.
But reversed.
Know, yeah.
It's just not Apollo Creed.
You know, how many gold medals did we win versus how many gold medals did you win? Well, we're a better, more powerful country because we hosted the Olympics and we won more medals. And that's a really big deal. And that, I think, is that idea in Russia, in probably China, 2008 Olympics, is... has to exist for the type of corruption, you know, for the conspiracy, the grandeur of conspiracy
that
occurred at the Sochi Olympics. And the movie does a wonderful job through these illustrations and graphics and stuff of playing the whole thing out. Hundreds of KGB officers being employed by Russian anti-doping.
Right.
You know,
he said there's 100 in the WADA lab, 150 people working there were for the FSB or the KGB.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so you can talk about tests are easy to pass. You know, this clears fast. That clears fast. I come off of this whenever, and besides that, for the most part, with real out-of-competition testing, which does not exist in Russia, it does not exist in so many of these countries because RUSADA ain't trying to catch their people. They're trying to protect them, as this movie clearly illustrates. Yeah. And if WADA comes to try and test them, well, guess what? They got to get a visa to get into the country, and they just delay that process, delay, delay, delay. Hey, are you guys clean yet? Okay, now you can come in. Or, hey, are you guys clean yet? No, you're not. Sorry, WADA, you're not allowed in.
All right.
And so, that stuff without out-of-competition testing is easy enough to beat. But then 2014 Sochi, Rodchenkov says, we need to come off at this point, and then they'll compete and be clean and test clean. And the way that the movie frames it, Vladimir Putin basically says, fuck that.
We're rolling in hot.
Yeah, we are guns a-blazing, juiced to the gills. He said, I don't want to take any chances of us not winning the most medals, of not winning the most gold medals, of not kicking the most ass here on the home turf to showcase the mighty power of Mother Russia to the whole world. But he
drinking from the fire hose.
Yeah. We're going all in and just find a way for them to be on the drugs the whole time. Yeah. And, newsflash, Vladimir Putin, no one gives a shit about the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, I think Chad and I are both in solid agreement that, while from a personal standpoint, that's fucking cool. Like, everyone gets loaded up and goes in and does it. But for skiing, let's do it for on
cross-country skiing.
I want to see the weightlifting and the shot put, the 100. Yeah. Let's do it on the cool sport, the cool Olympics, right?
If you're going to be so corrupt, at least really make it worth it and do it with the Summer Olympics.
Yeah.
Because the clip that they show in the movie where it's Russia on the whole podium, bronze, silver, and gold, I believe it was in the 50-kilometer cross-country skiing.
Right, which is kind of like, eh.
No one outside of the cross-country skiing world. And
9 fans.
Yeah.
There's less people that watch that than listen to the podcast.
Oh, definitely. I'll take that bet. So Putin says, hey, guys, they're not coming off. We're not taking any chances. We have to win, so they have to be on. Figure out a way to beat the test anyways. And that's when it goes from from a calendar about this is the time you stop taking test and this is the time you stop taking Anavar and this is the time you stop taking EPO to how the fuck do we get this fancy bottle top off of this specially made bottle?
Literally, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it went from here's the science about what kind of screwdriver do we need to pry this cap off?
It's a combination of a flathead and a Phillips. But so there are these special bottles and people, who compete in weightlifting and compete in the higher uplifters in the USAPL IPF who get the WADA tests know what this bottle looks like. They call it
a Berig kit.
Yeah, Berig kit, and it's a special bottle with this locking cap on it that you're supposed to have to destroy the bottle to get the sample out.
It's very tamper evident. So if you try to open it, it's obvious that somebody tried to do something. Mm. Right? It's not such an indestructible bottle or it's hard to open. It's just that it's very obvious when you try to open it if it's been tampered with.
Yeah.
So you could just inspect the bottle with, basically just look at it, I guess, and assume it'd be pretty easy to tell if someone's changed the caps.
Yeah, basically the cap is broken off or it's sealed.
Yeah,
still.
Or it's sealed,
you seal it and that's it. So it does not explain how they get the top off. Yeah, it seems like as they talk about these scratch marks inside of it,
yeah,
that maybe they developed some tool to do that. They don't explain it. Maybe they...
There's a couple of theories, actually, I was reading about last night. Some people were speculating that they broke the bottle itself and then removed the pieces and replaced the bottle with another one. Other people were saying they did the same with the cap, but because there's a serial code or a barcode on the cap, they may have had to...
imprinted into the glass of it.
Yeah, so you'd have to, remake the exact number again in another bottle. Very interesting. They had maybe someone speculated they had some special tools manufactured that allowed them to remove the cap, but either way, a very interesting problem.
Yeah, so the gist of it is samples get... Well, before the Olympics... All the athletes get clean for a bit. They pee. They keep those clean samples, store those away in the secret KGB storage refrigerator. Then the Olympics come, bringing the B samples in, bringing the A samples in. They get split onto these two carts. Russian guy slips the Russian athlete's B samples into his lab coat. A samples go over here. They go and change the B samples, bring those back, and now the A samples need to get changed too. But they've got the special bottle, but well, let's just slip this bottle through this hole in the wall. But a shadowy, shady conspiracy theory thing that could exist is what they were doing.
To the absolute degree of the most fucked up, corrupt shit you could possibly do. Slipping a bottle into a fucking hole in the wall, a glory hole of clean urine.
Three in the morning.
Yeah, and then some guy taking it to a special laboratory and secretly opening it, bringing it back. I mean, just like to the absolute... what's interesting to me is that it's the most primitive solution when you think about it. It's just, we'll just switch the urine out for clean urine. And that sounds like, well, all these measures that have been taken by WADA or the anti-doping to prevent that very simple process, which is like, you can be as dirty as you want, just use clean urine. They just found a way to sort of circumvent all these little tiny things in place that would prevent that from happening.
And it goes along with, as far as like the specific gravity and adding sodium chloride to change the specific gravity of the urine so it matches up with the original sample, because that testing process is very involved. I know Marissa's gotten the WADA panel tests and they're in there for a long time, because there's so many procedures to it and safeguards for the athlete, to avoid tampering, but also, just safeguards to the whole process. And in the movie, they're in the meeting. Brian Fogel is in the meeting and kind of becomes, when it becomes apparent that shit is going down, guys are having heart attacks. The head of RUSADA has a heart attack a week after this gets revealed. And another high up person also has a heart attack.
His heart exploded when the bullet hit it.
And so they get Rodchenkov out of Russia, and Brian kind of becomes his, facilitator for all this legal work and helping him work with the Department of Justice, and they release this information to the New York Times. But, once they realize that shit is just going down.
Yeah, it's going south.
Yeah, it's... It really is a remarkable story in it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he leaves Russia, right? And he's kind of forced to leave his wife and kids at home, and that's just like, who knows where he was at with all that, but like that's a very a challenging thing to do, because you're leaving them in basically the most dangerous place they could be, right? Yeah, that's a scary thought.
Yeah, they're definitely taking their anti-doping
very
extremely seriously. All for some really non-existent glory that comes from...
Well, I think there's obviously the undertone of the whole documentary, and not to get anything political, but there's a lot of the, obviously the Russian thing and whatever's going on in the news now with Russia and collusion stuff. So all of that, I think... plays a big role in probably to some degree how the film came out at this time and those kind of things.
If they're willing to go this far
in sport, would they go that far? And yeah, other, yeah, I mean,
for cross country skiing medals, what else will they do a lot of work for? We're totally losing our cross country skiing audience.
What if there was a huge, the huge cross country skiing? People have been waiting for the article on general training for cross country skiing for years now. Not coming out. Hypertrophy, hypertrophy for the biathlon. You're never getting it. That's not true. You might. But, yeah, I mean, so I think there's probably a big thing there. In the movie, too, they kind of allude to the political tool may be more an asset to him, to Putin, for his own people, for Russia. Yeah, more so than the rest of the world, right? Where you know.
Also, the real sports talk seems to talk more about how Putin wanted the Olympics to be, like, show the whole world, like, you know, Russia's doing great. We're still powerful and everything. And then in Icarus, they basically say, you know, that Putin's approval rating, which that part is a clip from the Real Sports episode, oh, really? Because I just recognized the
graphic or whatever,
the narrator's voice. Oh. But that his approval rating had been kind of falling for a couple of years, and then it's like Olympics.
Yeah.
95% approval rating.
Russians love their Olympics.
Yeah. Oh, everybody loves me again? Well, fuck you, Ukraine.
Yeah. Let me attack Ukraine.
Yeah. So that saying that he used, you know, that them beating the test was so important to gain this political power so he could be more aggressive.
I guess, Anderson, you got to think about Rodchenkov's position there, knowing that you're essentially the linchpin that allowed that situation to occur, because if they had all lost and failed drug tests,
yeah,
that would have just been a totally different world for a lot of people in Ukraine.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
Imagine
within
what goes through his, you can, yeah, I didn't even think about it until now, but you can imagine Rodchenkov's psyche.
It seems like Rodchenkov acknowledges that in there, yeah, that he has remorse and
for what's happened,
and maybe, yeah, that's part of the reason why he wanted to make this information public and go to New York Times and the Department of Justice with it. Now, it's a bit unclear to me in it what the U.S. Department of Justice is investigating.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff that probably doesn't that.
Like what? Why, yeah, he's getting a deal? Well, one, it begs the bigger question: is why does the U.S. Department of Justice give a fuck about steroids at all? Let alone steroids in Russia?
Right.
Why? Where is the jurisdiction there? I mean, it's stupid enough when they're spending millions and millions of dollars to put Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens on trial, yeah, because who gives a fuck?
Right.
But at least they're, yeah, Americans.
Right. Like, right. Yeah. It's just a very, yeah, it's the conspiracy thing, right? Yeah. They just want to charge people with broad conspiracy so they can get them, right?
Yeah. Get them for the sake of getting them. Get them because they think it's still 1982.
Because it matters.
And, yeah. And, you know, the Olympic boycotts,
I just think,
are a big political move.
The problem
and stuff,
is that people in the Department of Justice at the highest levels have never actually been to West Side, so they don't know what goes on there. That's the biggest problem. If you just went there, you'd realize it's not, I mean, you'd see it. It's not a big deal, guys.
Yeah, so the scale of efforts and the political implications of beating the testing and it propping Putin up and Russia up in the global political community is, you know, probably above Max's and my pay grade to discuss. But what is interesting about it is the implications for the rest of sport and the rest of the sporting world. This corruption was so far-reaching, was, you know, the highest of high levels in Russia. I mean, Putin has got to be second, third most powerful, you know, political figure in the world.
Yeah,
and he's getting involved in this. So it begs the question, you know, how does this go in other countries? Obviously, Russia sees sports and the Olympics as this political tool, a grand show in Sochi Olympics and a grand showing by the athletes there was sort of this badge of honor for Russia, or in Putin's eyes, for Russia in the international political community. Within Russia, it bolstered his approval rating to be able to make this attack on the Ukraine. So do other countries see beating doping tests as a means to an end of political success, of nationalism, of, you know, we won a bunch of medals and now everyone around the world thinks that we're a great country.
Yeah.
And because if they do, and it's likely that Russia is not the only person who, you know, the only country who has that kind of feeling, then it's not out of the question that other countries are having, you know, far reaching up to the president, prime minister of their country, helping them beat drug tests. Does China see sport and the Olympics as this big political tool, and that their success in sport means that they're more...
That's a very... What do you think would happen if... Because let's assume that's the case. If it's happening in Russia, it's happening everywhere, right? Let's assume that all these powers that are dominant, even including here, let's just assume everybody's in there. If you eliminated the possibility of drug failures, let's just say you allow drug use in sport, what does that suddenly do to the landscape of do sports just become kind of irrelevant after that? Because
well, that seems like it's the argument that Dick Pound, who was like the former head of WADA or USADA, and mostly just has a funny name.
Not as impressive as the name. Yeah. The man is not as impressive as the name.
Do you think that there's like a European guy with the equivalent name?
Dick Kilogram?
Yeah, Dick Kilo.
Dick Kilo.
But they probably have a different word.
There's
than
one
Dick.
In each guy. There's one in the UK, Dick Stone.
Stone Maybe Richard Stone Richard Stone.
Richard Stone.
Oh, that's good. yeah, I mean, it's... I am...
Because if you can't show anyone, like, okay, everyone gets to take drugs, so anybody can basically, any of the talented people can basically do really well, and it's going to be a crapshoot, because then it really comes down to everyone's on drugs, so that there's no advantage now to the drugs that you, like, one person's not going to have them and the other person is. You're going to come down to finding special people, but it won't exist, like, where you have a full team of freaks, right?
I mean,
with the exception of probably the United States having such a massive pool to draw from, that you're going to have a lot more talented people here coming up to that level.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is Dick Pound tries to argue that in the movie, well, if we let everyone take drugs, or if everyone's taking drugs, or when Fogel is in the meeting with all those WADA people and all these WADA employees high up, level WADA folks are just like, holy shit, they just beat us at every turn. You know, like, what are we doing here?
Right, right.
And they try and make the argument that it's cheating the spectator and stuff. And I don't think that the spectators give a shit.
No.
I think it's sort of like an ignorance is bliss situation.
For sure.
CrossFit Games last weekend. CrossFit's drug testing policy is total, complete bullshit.
It's a joke.
And the people love watching it. CrossFit Games people love watching the CrossFit Games.
Yeah.
Because most of them don't understand that it's complete and total bullshit, because they get fed these, you know, 18th place at regionals tested positive and this 17th place masters guy. But no, none of the people above them, like, because they control the results. So I think that's a scenario on a micro scale, you know, compared to the Olympic movement and everything, where they're showing that the fans don't really care.
Well, look at, like, football and baseball.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, no one really gives a shit if, like, you know, Sean Merriman's taking a bunch of Nandrolone. Like,
yeah, they get four-game suspension.
Yeah.
And does that – I mean, who even has tested positive? Like, Sean Merriman, yeah.
That's he the tested last one I remember.
Positive. I know there was a guy from the Cowboys this year who will have his second suspension, 10 games. 4 games last year, now 10 games for testing positive again. A track athlete, a weightlifter, they're done. Their career is done. Justin Gatlin, you know, 2 positive tests. He didn't have a lifetime ban because the first one was like his freshman year of college for Adderall, and not having a TUA, TUA for Adderall, he got a 6-month.
TUA for Adderall, that'll get you.
Yeah. And you know, later had a more serious suspension for anabolics. He was getting booed by the entire stadium.
Yeah.
Like, those guys get crucified in track.
That's brutal.
Where, you know, baseball and football, no one really bats an eye at it.
It's
the NFL doesn't seem concerned about you know, losing fans because people are popping for drugs. They just want to watch the biggest, fastest, gnarliest dudes ever destroy the shit out of each other.
Blow each other's brains up.
Yeah. I mean, they're more concerned with the brains blowing out these days.
Yeah, that's a little more of an issue now. But
yeah.
So I think that's interesting, right? So you assume, like, if you get rid of drug failure, if you just can't – it's not an issue. Drugs or whatever. Take them, don't take them. No one cares.
Like, track in the 80s, so popular.
Yeah.
Really no positive tests.
Right. And so what then becomes of – what then becomes of the sport, right? It becomes a spectacle, which it already is, I mean, because they're already doing this. And – The political power, the tool is completely gone because
the corruption is gone.
Right, the corruption is gone. So now you can't just cheat your way through, right? And you're forced to be, you know, the sport. It would actually make sport more fair because
people
would basically have to develop more ingenious, more creative ways to both use the drugs and train and develop results that would rely more on human ingenuity. Then I think, you know, well, the same ingenuity going towards passing tests would now be directed towards the actual training process.
Yeah. And I've said that before. If you want to have a level playing field, you say do whatever you want. Because someone, some place, some country, some people are always going to get around it. Whether it's Valco designer steroids that they don't know how to test for, whether it's coming off at the right time and avoiding out of competition testing through customs and different levels of corruption there, or whether it's fucking 100 KGB officers making a special tool to take the cap off this bottle and switch it with the other bottle in the middle of the night, they're gonna beat the test. I mean, WADA officials in the movie are flabbergasted by they're just hanging with their jaw open like, we're not even fucking close to stopping
it. Yeah. I really hope that bottle cap opening thing is like a Rube Goldberg machine. It took 30 minutes, like a bowling ball has to fall on a string to open it. Here's a question that for you is what ramifications do you think from 1968 till now, the reliance on the fact that you're going to be doped has had on the Russian, the Soviet sort of creativity in discovering the training process or the knowledge of training? Has the model been sort of stilted because of this? Because, like, do you think they didn't get further along and discover more, create more, or that's been hindered by this?
That's a very good question. I would say, and we've talked about this before, as the U.S. has foreign weightlifting coaches come over or coaches who are still coaching in other countries, and they think that U.S. weightlifters are all on drugs, that we're just bad at weightlifting, where the reality of it is no, we're actually probably the best at drug-free weightlifting.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
At training drug-free weightlifters. And if all of weightlifting did, you know, tomorrow become drug-free, that the U.S. knows how to do that better. We don't know how to play the game that the other countries are playing better than they do, but we know how to play the drug-free game better than they do. So I think a lot of training on drugs, off of drugs, is not by, you know, not changes of type of training, but changes of magnitude of training. So whether that's a coach having to relearn and refine the ranges that are, you know, appropriate for overloading and fatigue management for their athletes now, and instead of doing, you know, six triples at 85%, now they can do three triples at 77% or something.
Right, right.
It's changes like that. You know, does it discount the learnings and the teachings of someone like Dr. Bondarchuk in special strength exercises? Because if Yuri Sadiq and Litvinov are on a bunch of steroids, maybe they don't have to do as much general strength training. Right. They can just spend a lot more time on special strength stuff. That's a very good question. When I don't think there's an easy answer for.
Cool. Yeah.
But so the last point that I want to talk about, you know, is how far reaching this was. And I started to touch on it. Surprisingly or unsurprisingly, went on a few tangents, was if Russia sees this as sport as a political tool and they are willing to have such far-reaching corruption to defeat drug tests. Does China see sport as a similar political tool, and does that motivate them to do the same type of thing? Does Jamaica see the success of their sprinters as something that bolsters their, you know, national profile? With track and field world championships going on now, or just having finished, there's a lot of talk about Justin Gatlin defeating Usain Bolt in what was Bolt's last individual race, and how Gatlin's tested positive twice, and why is he being allowed to race? People were pissed; they were booing him in the stands. He was getting no love. If you look at the list of the top 50 fastest 100 meter times ever, top 50 fastest 100 meter times ever. And you cross off, so this would be every fast time that Usain Bolt has run on there, every fast time that Justin Gatlin, Tyson Gay, Asafa Powell, Nesta Carter, Johan Blake, all these people, Tim Montgomery, and you cross off all the names, all the people who have tested positive on it, of the top 50 fastest times ever, you know how many names are left? Usain Bolt, the only one. Yeah. And this isn't to say, I can't on one hand say about USAPL lifters and USA weightlifting athletes, if they're passing the test, they're clean. And on the other hand say, well, Usain Bolt's the only person who's not tested positive, so he must be dirty. But that has to be with the understanding that Usain Bolt is the biggest thing in
yeah.
Jamaica. Like, he is he's making their economy kind of thing. Like, he's getting all the national governmental support possible, and the extent of that governmental support, if Jamaica wants to do it like Russia, and this isn't even for 50 different athletes or 100 different athletes, it's just protecting one fucking guy, that they can let all the other people test positive, and they're just like, here you go, Wada. Here's $1 million. Here's another million. Right. Here's another million. Just don't let him test positive. Because you think fucking track and field wants Usain Bolt to test positive? And that's the argument I hear the most is, if Bolt tests positive, then track is dead. Because we've had so many. Everyone tests positive. That they can't sustain it anymore. That he's the one shining, protected star. And that, he can do no wrong. And now he's retiring, so it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But
I mean, therein lies the whole issue, right?
Yeah.
Is that you just can't get around. Yeah, I mean, it's the whole doublespeak, right?
Yeah.
And
does the end justify the means?
Right. Right.
To Russia, the end that was invading the Ukraine or bolstering their political profile on the international stage justified the means of, this insane level of corruption, of people getting paid off, of people, sneaking the urine stuff, from people getting fucking murdered, from people losing their life because, they didn't go along with the plan as they were supposed to. Does the end justify the means for other countries in regards to anti-doping?
Yeah.
Is a big question. It's one worth discussing. It's something, watch the movie, listen to this podcast, let us know your thoughts in the comments, because it's a discussion, I guess, that's a bit bigger than sports. It's bigger than at least sets and reps and if you should bend your knees or your hips first in the squat type of talk.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge philosophical discussion there.
Anything else about Icarus?
I'm not sure the age. I don't know what's rated. Probably PG-13 or maybe R.
No,
it might have been some vulgarity. Definitely a lot of Eastern European half nudity. Very Eastern European, no shirt. Many times by Rodchenkov.
Excellent mustache.
Phenomenal mustache.
When I saw some of the previews, particularly of the scene where him and Brian Fogel are sitting across the table from each other doing like a more interview style. I had seen the interviews and I was like, didn't quite know what the movie was. And I was like, is this like a dramatization of this whole situation? And I was like, this guy's got to be wearing fake eyebrows and a fake mustache with those glasses.
If it was, his character name in the credits would have been like generic Russian scientist or something. Yeah.
Vladimir Sportnitsky.
Sportnitsky. Yeah. It was a very good film. Highly recommend it. I think that's probably all the things I can think of about it. I mean, it was really good. It was very, very eye-opening. Very, very thought-provoking.
Yeah. And because even for, I think both you and I are cynics in this whole situation,
sure.
but have maybe a deeper understanding than most would of the reality of it. There were parts to both of us that were very eye-opening. Yeah. That were like
shocking.
Yeah.
Crazy shit.
Yeah.
Crazy shit.
And I mentioned this last night when we were watching, like, Brian Fogel at some point in this had to just be like, holy shit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that scene where all the water people, everyone, like, because you kind of know it and you've met the people involved at the base level.
Yeah.
To sit there and be like, yeah, I mean, this has been going on for like 50 years.
Yeah.
And no one's like, they have records of everybody back to day one.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Fogel was a virgin to doping.
Yeah.
And
yeah, to come into that and just be like,
yeah, he thought he was coming in for maybe a little bit of this, and then it was just like, no, there's Caligula level Caligula. Orgies of doping going on here. You weren't ready for this, kid. Yeah, he had to just have his mind blown by the whole process.
Yeah, brutal.
Icarus on Netflix. Check it out. Give this a listen. Let us know what you think about our thoughts here. Coming up, seminar-wise, the weekend of August 25th and 26th, so about 10 days from the time that this podcast is released, Max and I will be in Buffalo, New York at Mustache Fitness and Barbell giving our first Super Total Clinic.
Yep.
That's powerlifting one day, weightlifting the other day, talking about how to combine them as well, train them independently and combined. So go and sign up for that. After that, I will be in Philadelphia on September 16th at Warhorse Barbell, giving a lecture on powerlifting program design, beginner, intermediate, advanced, how to apply the scientific principles of strength training, how I do it for our athletes from club powerlifting coaching all the way up to world record holders, guys totaling 2,300 pounds. After that, Max will be in Santa Barbara at CrossFit Santa Barbara, very creatively named, on September 30th. And then he and Pomp the following weekend will be at CrossFit Park Avenue in Rochester, New York.
Yep.
I don't really think of Park Avenue when I think of Rochester.
I feel like it's like the poor man's Park Avenue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in Rochester. It can't be, so you're...
So Max and Pomp will be up there on October 6th for a weightlifting clinic. And then I will be in Minneapolis at the Movement Minneapolis on October 28th, giving another programming lecture. So go check all of those out. Plus, juggernautcoaching.com. We have multiple levels of coaching for multiple disciplines, powerlifting, weightlifting, and super total. Kind of whatever level you're at, beginner, intermediate, advanced, we have something that's appropriate for you. So visit juggernautcoaching.com to learn more about that. Subscribe to the YouTube. We're really proud of the content we make here. We got Shorty Sedang, world's strongest videographer, pound for pound, without a doubt.
For sure.
I mean, Wilkes, no other videographer could match.
There's no one.
Yeah. And always proud of the content we produce here. So subscribe to the channel. Tell your friends who are interested in becoming better educated about how to lift pieces of metal attached to other pieces of metal.
Sometimes rubber.
Yeah. Rubber-covered metal, and the occasional delve into the psyche of world leaders and the global political implications of clean or dirty urine. We'll talk about that too. This is the Jug Life Podcast. If you like it, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play. We should be on iHeartRadio pretty soon. I got to email the podcast guys about that. The Stitcher app and the juglife.com. Maximum, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, max_Ada, or on Facebook. You can email me about any of the Juggernaut online coaching platforms at maxjtsstrength.com.
I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training. Filling up your news feed all day on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for watching, and we will see you next week.